So they say the third time is a charm, but this is actually like the fifth time, really, if you think about it. We recorded on Monday, and my audio was screwed up. We recorded again yesterday, and this time Nina's audio was screwed up. This is now our third attempt today. We're using new software, and it appears the both of us are being recorded. Are you excited, Nina?
I am super excited to get this in the bag.
You sound so irritated. I was afraid. I was literally afraid to tell you that the second recording was botched. And so I tried to record on my own, but I literally felt like I was talking to myself in the grocery store. So I nixed that. And I said, oh, I'll wait for you to wake up. Because if our listeners don't know, Nina and I have a 10-hour time difference between us. So it makes teaming up not complicated, but it can be difficult sometimes. Alrighty, let's jump right in. Let's do a quick mailbag thing. Nina, what do we got?
Okay, so this week we're not exactly a question, but one of our listeners commented about Anthony Tony Ponytail Perillo. That is a tongue twister, you guys.
Yeah.
And Dennis Roach, the murder of Rocky DeSantis and the later murder of Dennis Roach, allegedly by Anthony Porky DeSantis. Now, for some reason that I can't quite remember, I went down a Rocky DeSantis rabbit hole a couple of weeks ago, so we can't let all of my research go to waste.
Absolutely not, and we will get there. Roach was killed in 1981, so we'll be doing an episode about his murder and the other murders in 81, basically a hit parade episode, but that will be after we cover the murder of Georgie Pappas at the Four Seas in Chinatown. I'd say late summer we'll be getting around to that. And as far as Ponytail goes, he's still alive, I believe. He was sentenced to 5 years in 2020, so he should be out on the street, but he will be popping up later this season and in season 3.
Okay, so let's move on in order to save time and spare our listeners an earache, and I know everyone's excited for us to get into this and been waiting impatiently. So,
all right. So why don't we recap what we did last week?
We started last week with our three-part series on the Bonded Vault, and we just profiled kind of everybody's backgrounds and did a bit of a backstory on our robbers.
Mm-hmm. And I think you found out that there's a chance that Joe, the dancer, Denise, still alive?
Yes. It seems that he is. I have to check into that for sure. But I will say longevity certainly seems to run in his genes. He'd be like 89 now, I think, just turned. And his mom lived to 91 and his maternal grandfather to 93. So longevity is definitely...
Okay. Well, maybe you'll find out. And maybe one of our listeners might also know. That's possible. Sometimes we have family members that listen. Okay, so today we're going to cover beginning of 1975 leading up to the robbery in August and what was going on. We're going to try to cover things that other people haven't. There's been so many podcasts and articles and books and then the movie that neither of us have actually watched. So we don't want to regurgitate all of that. Hopefully we bring up some things that other people didn't cover. And I want to say that this heist was listed as one of the top five heists by the Mob Museum out in Las Vegas. Right, Nina?
Yes. And that was kind of a fun read. So we'll definitely maybe do a special on some of the other ones.
Mm-hmm, which we've already done the Plymouth Mail Truck.
And we did the Plymouth Mail Truck. And obviously we will get to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum at some point in time. So.
Especially since Dad was linked to both of those. So, okay. So tell us what was going on in the beginning of 1975 with Raymond getting paroled from prison.
So Raymond was paroled on January 9th, I think, 1975. And so we kind of covered that a little bit in the episode of the Hit Parade of 1975. So check that out. But that does play a role in one of the main theories about the heist and who was the main beneficiary of this project.
Correct. So Raymond, as Nina said, was released on parole on January 9th from the ACI Cranston, and he was given parole rather than letting him wrap up his sentence in September of 75 so that the government could have him under tight supervision.
Right. And so tight supervision was literally, he had to check in with a parole officer, his parole officer, every 24 hours. And he called up the Associated Press the following year. It was almost 1 year to the date of his parole, to complain about his status as a parolee. And he said that at my age, all I want to do is to be left alone to live out my life. I'm the only person in the state of Rhode Island who has to report where they are every 24 hours. I've been working hard and staying out of trouble. Now, working hard, the FBI had eyes on him like all the time. And they said he was looking out the window of the coin-o-matic watching people go by. So
he was guarding the neighborhood. That's a lot of work. You have to wrangle all those guys in Providence, Federal Hill. That's a lot of work.
Well, his female parole officer backed him up, too. She called him completely cooperative and praised him as the best parolee on her caseload.
He had his charms.
I guess. But that was, it was interesting because he called them up like the same, or the day after the Bonded Vault arrest. So it was almost like he was giving himself cover.
Oh, he probably was distancing himself and saying he was on good behavior. Right.
Yeah.
Which makes perfect sense. And speaking of the press, on the day that Raymond was sprung, in January of 75, he left the prison at 4:45 a.m. to allow him to get home without hordes of reporters clamoring for a pic of him.
And according to informant statements after the heist, Raymond was upset that his take had been light while he was away. Supposedly, he believed that the guys were skimming because he was locked up.
And this theory makes the most sense. Had Raymond not sanctioned the heist, would any of the culprits have been out there spending a dime, or would they be pushing up daisies?
Well, exactly. And how many people knew about the Bonded Vault, which was owned by Hudson Services, Inc. in the first place?
All right, so not many, and the company really wasn't advertising what they were doing besides furs and a few other things.
Right. Samuel Levine, the owner, had placed some ads for the Bonded Vault in the Providence Journal that I found in 64 and early 65. It's probably about like a 6 month period where he did that. But then the ad suddenly stopped, and most people knew the location at Cranston Ave as a fur storage and repair company. And they'd been in there since they owned the building since the 40s.
And the building was a church?
Yeah, it was a church for about probably, I think, 80 years or something before that.
Wow.
And then it was partially destroyed in the Great New England Hurricane of 38. And then the Levines paid a bunch of money to fix it up and turned it into a cold storage. But they were operating other businesses out of the address as well that they advertised.
And we should also mention that it was rumored that the Levine brothers were a front for Raymond and that Raymond actually owned Hudson Furs and the Bonded Vault, but there's never been any actual proof of that presented.
Right. So not to say that it wasn't true, especially considering who the Levine brothers had for clients.
Well, their clients were mostly coin dealers from what we know, and there's always a coin dealer or a stamp collector in these stories.
Well, the youngest Levine brother, Matt, was also dealing in that space, so that's not a huge surprise. He probably had a pretty decent network going. But not pointing fingers or anything, I recall that you had one of those special coin collections when you were a kid.
Yeah, and I had a stamp collection, too, along with a bunch of other collections, quote-unquote. They went missing one day, along with dozens of other things, including my Stradivarius. I was probably about 10 when I realized that absolutely anything that Dad gave me was going to go missing at some point in time. And it probably took me about another 5 years to figure out that all of those gifts were just hot items that he was stashing with me. What a perfect place to stash stuff.
Well, there's definitely more than one story there, and we'll probably get into it later. But let's get back to these hot items and the men who relieved the owners of their ill-gotten gains. For our listeners who aren't familiar with the story, just to recap, the men were Robert the Deuce Dussault, his friend Charles Chucky Flynn, Joe the Dancer DeNeesi, Gerald Jerry Tillinghast, Ralph S. Skippy Burns, John Wimette, brother of Jerry Wimette, their cousin Walter, and Jack Tarzian. And we covered much of their criminal history in the previous episode.
Chucky Flynn had escaped in October 1974 and made his way to Rhode Island, where he assumed the false identity of Richard Hanna, The FBI 302s are heavily redacted about this, but it appears that John Ouimet had helped Chucky get a union job, although reportedly Chucky was a no-show more often than not. Dussault would later allege that it was during this period that Chucky and Ralph DeMasi had killed Joe Schiavone, but we'll get into that when we cover DeMasi later this year.
And DeMasi, as we noted in the previous episode, was pinched in early July and ended up at the ACI in Cranston with Jerry Ouimet. Now, this is purely my own speculation, but it does seem likely that Patriarca gave the bonded vault job to Jerry Ouimet, and then Ouimet and DeMasi arranged to each pick some of their guys to form a crew.
Highly likely. Flynn got a girlfriend, was living with her in her house in East Providence, and that was where Dussault landed after he pulled his runner.
In July, right? That was in
correct,
July also.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So later during the trial, Dussault told the court that they started planning the robbery about 2 weeks prior, around the beginning of August. He said that John Ouimet came to the home that he and Chucky were living in at 5 Gulf Ave in East Providence and told them that he had a good score for them. John returned a few days later and took them to the location of the bonded vault.
Then on the 13th anniversary of the Plymouth Mail robbery, they pulled it off.
I did not make that connection.
And I can hear your little wheels over there spinning around, but the robbery was actually planned for August 13th. While they were prepping one of the stolen vehicles, a cop rolled by and it spooked them, so they delayed the heist for a day.
Well, you can't blame a girl for trying.
Plus, robbing on the 13th, is that, like, really a good idea? But I'm superstitious. So anyhow, on August 14th, the eight of them piled into a stolen van in the sweltering summer heat to pull off the heist of their lives. They arrived at Hudson Furs around 8 a.m., and the first to enter was Dussault. He passed a slip of paper with four names written on it to one of the owners of Hudson Furs.
Now, Dussault later stated that he got the names from John Ouimet, but if we're going with the Patriarca theory on this, it seems it was people that Raymond Felt owed him big time. And in court the following year, Samuel Levine testified to only three names, not four. They were the Bingo Man, Babe, and Mike Ross, but he only admitted to being able to identify the first, a man named Jerome Geller. And Jerry Geller was literally a bingo promoter and was later indicted for tax fraud as a result of the heist. So Raymond got his revenge in spades, I guess.
Well, one would imagine he did. And Samuel Levine likely didn't want to be on the receiving end of any of that vengeance. So he was understandably less than cooperative with Dussault. So two of his brothers, his sister-in-law, and an employee named Barbara Oliva were tied up and hooded with pillowcases.
Now, Levine later testified that one of the robbers claimed to have keys to open the boxes, but that he told them that they would need a master key.
But wouldn't Levine, like, always have that key with him? Because I'm imagining the setup was like, you know, bank safety deposit boxes used to be. You go in, you have your key, the bank has their key, they then open the box with you and then leave you alone. So wouldn't he have the key?
Well, maybe he left it home because he knew it was going to happen, but maybe we'll find out when we get to the trial next week.
Maybe. I just think that Raymond told him, hey, leave the key at home, make it look more, don't make it look too easy, you know, that kind of a thing.
Well, we'll never know for sure, but we do know that with the employees secured, Chucky Flynn led part of the crew into the building. But accessing the vault area wasn't going to be easy. The equipment they brought with them to core through the locks wasn't doing the trick. They were burning out bit after bit, but finally someone in the group thought to use a crowbar to pop the hinges, which to their pleasant surprise solved their problem. So there were a total of 146 safe deposit boxes measuring 2 feet high, 2 feet wide, and 5 feet deep. Imagine how much loot you could fit in that.
Oh, a whole bunch of stuff. Later, during one of the interviews of the employees, Miss Oliva reported that they could hear the sounds of the thieves' elation each time they popped a vault door open. They loaded the cash, coins, gems, precious metals, and other treasures into 7 duffel bags and loaded them into the trunk of another stolen vehicle, a Chevy Monte Carlo, which they had parked nearby for their use for escape.
Okay, now you said the Chevy Monte Carlo was a two-door?
It's a two-door. A big, okay. Long-body, giant, 1970s before-your-time two-door.
I mean, I can kind of imagine it, at least.
It was like a boat.
Yes.
Seriously.
I remember seeing those.
Okay.
The trunk was nearly scraping the pavement, and the hull was so great that they had to abandon their efforts and leave many other treasures behind, including a chalice.
And we would never ever leave a chalice behind. even if we were getting into a two-door coupe instead of a sedan. But anyhow, I still think that the chalices were kiddish cups.
Well, maybe. I still kind of doubt that, though.
You're always ranting on my parade, but I'll get over it. The entire production took a little over an hour to pull off. Before departing, the Duce deposited the hostages into a tiny bathroom, securing the door with a chair, and ensured the hostages' cooperation with a death threat that if they didn't sit tight for 10 minutes, they would all be cooked.
Well, when the cops showed up, there were piles of cash, silver and gold ingots, gems, pistols, machine guns, and what Lara covets most, chalices strewn about the area.
Kiddish cups.
I think it's your Norman jeans that are overriding there.
Well, it takes one to know one.
But think of the irony. Chalices in the building that housed the vault had formerly been a church.
True, 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 and it was perfect for a movie set, obviously.
Obviously. But I do wonder whose estate in Maine had been robbed for most of this stuff.
Well, it brings me back, or it makes me think of the story that we did about Vinnie Teresa with the jade and the ivory that they had robbed from Maine, and he had down in his house in the Cape there, and poor Henry Tamelia was driving around in the dark trying to find the house. So I always think of, you know, some fantastic house in, you know, Kennebunkport or something that they stole all of these goodies out of.
Well, early estimates put the haul at $1 million, and then law enforcement estimated the haul at $3 million, and later estimates were as high as $30 million, and I think I've even seen like $32
million. Right, and that was in 1975 time money, not in some extrapolated amount to match today's money.
Right, exactly.
All right. And here's the kicker. The next day, the Greenfield Reporter ran an article noting that the once model prisoner, Dussault, had been missing for 6 weeks after his shopping spree for the sheriff's carpets went awry and he and his jailer took a side trip to the strip joint. An all-points bulletin had been issued and the FBI had been alerted to his escape, but they couldn't have been looking too hard.
Yeah, a common theme.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of people who were on the lam, and I swear this is not off topic, I pinky swear promise, Louis Minocchio's friend and attorney, Thomas DeLuglia, was named receiver after Bonded Vault filed for receivership on Friday the 15th. Longtime listeners might recall DeLuglia from our episode on Minocchio's travels around the world. And they might remember that on Sunday, August 17th, Andrew Minocchio's house was blown up while they were on vacation. Another coincidence.
Yeah, sure. I still think it's all connected.
It has to be, and my conspiracy theory brain won't let me think otherwise, so I believe you.
Okay, we got to move on. Ten days later, on August 27th, the authorities identified the Duce as the ringleader of the crew, and they called him Natalie, dressed in a gray checked suit.
I would imagine an on-the-lam thief would have automatically landed on the suspects list.
Well, speaking of the suspects, according to Tim White and others, each of them received $64,000 for the heist, including Raymond and Patrick Jr.
Other sources claim $35,000 for each of them, which brings us to what the boys were up to immediately afterwards. Robert, Chucky, and Chucky's girlfriend Ellen hopped on a flight to Vegas, the perfect place for a degenerate gambler like Chucky.
And when Chucky wasn't hitting the crap tables, he was trying to get hitched to Ellen. And love was in the air for the Duce as well, who fell for a hooker named Corinne.
But things weren't all rosy in Vegas. Chucky's gambling was out of control, and when all of Ellen's pleas fell on deaf ears, she reached out to the Duce, hoping that he could help. And what did the Duce learn from that phone call?
That Chucky had robbed from all of them. She told him that he had gone through all of the $500 bills already.
And Chucky didn't have a clue what she was talking about. I'm sorry, Dussault didn't have a clue what she was talking about. Chucky pocketed those $500 bills faster than I would have snagged the kiddish cup / chalice and never said a word to anyone. According to White, it didn't bother the Duce that Chucky kept something extra for himself, but...
Well, Dussault managed to convince Flynn to go back to Rhode Island, and he and his girlfriend took a road trip to California.
But the Duce kept checking in with Chucky, trying to find out what happened to the rest of the haul. Supposedly, Chucky and the other guys pooled roughly $8,500 together to appease the Duce, but he wanted more, which, again, why would he be looking for more money if the fact that Chucky snagged the $500 bills didn't bother him? The Duce was indicted on 20 counts, including kidnapping, robbery, and assault with a deadly weapon on September 3rd.
And with Dussault's face plastered across the front page of the Providence Journal, the powers that be decided he needed to go, and Flynn was the man to do it.
You know, during the trial, Levine's secretary, Barbara Oliva, testified that she could have easily identified Chucky Flynn because he wasn't wearing a mask. But there was wrangling over her identification of the Deuce during the trial, so it just brings up lots of questions for me. But
well, obviously, Flynn failed at his mission to take out DuSalt. After all, they were close. I do have to say here that the comment we made in the last episode that they were childhood friends is false. They had been friends for roughly a decade from their time in prison, and that was enough to keep Flynn from harming him.
And that's why you have to research everything twice. Anyhow, I suspect that Flynn was also a bit susceptible to the Deuce's manipulations, as it appears he convinced Flynn that the Rhode Island guys were using him.
Meanwhile, the Providence Journal obtained at least a partial list of the box holders and released it to the public. One of the names was Frederick Carrazza, the son of Phil Carrazza, who had been a longtime business partner of Raymond Patriarca's. Phil Carrazza's older son, Samuel, was on the paperwork of the National Cigarette Service with Patriarca. Phil had passed away in the summer of 71 when Raymond was still in prison and down in Atlanta.
The Carrazzas owned the infamous Coin-O-Matic, which was using the same address as Raymond's National Cigarette Service, good old 168 Atwells Ave.
Well, my favorite part of that arrangement was that they shared the same switchboard, which was answered by the Carrazza boy's sister.
And who better than family to do that?
True. Other names that the Providence Journal reported who had boxes in storage were Joseph DiCarlo, Eugene Carlino, and William Lamferi. No, DiCarlo was an associate of Dennis Raimondi's, so we'll come back to that story later on when we do Denny's demise.
Mm-hmm.
The last two were coin dealers who were under indictment by the IRS for tax evasion. They'd been under indictment since, like, March of the same of 75, I think.
Right,
so
right.
Prior to the heist.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's how they came on Raymond's radar, though.
Oh, possibly.
Carlino was business partners with Matthew Levine, whose brother was the official owner of Bonded Vault. And as we mentioned earlier, according to FBI informants in Providence, Patriarca owned Bonded Vault and Samuel Levine was fronting for him, which just sounds so Soviet to me, but
or at least very Russian.
But I do have to say here, the FBI's informants were so full of misinformation and disinformation that it is really hard to say what was true and what wasn't, and you can only imagine the Fed's frustration with not being able to nail Raymond on this job.
Oh, you know, they were going crazy. In the meantime, the IRS alleged that Lamferi owed $500,000 in back taxes. Lamferi claimed that he couldn't recall what was in his safe deposit box at the Bonded Vault. Come on. Matt Levine would later testify at trial that he had lost $100,000 in cash that he had stored there.
Now, another name that came up in the investigation was Bob Jedson. And I know this is minutia, but you guys have to hear this story. When asked, the detective investigating the Bonded Vault case said, well, Bob Jedson may have existed at one point, and eventually it was revealed that Bob was actually a man named Frank Babe Koval. Babe was already under indictment for possession of stolen goods and was using four boxes at the Bonded Vault to stash his loot. Think about how much loot he had.
Oh, he was a very industrious Polish boy.
My theory is that Babe was also the Babe on Raymond's list of people who owed him. And then, in late October, Babe's business in West Warwick mysteriously burned to the ground.
Mysteriously or suspiciously?
Well, you know. We're going to have to come back to Babe when we get into the 80s, because there was so much going on there, and he was totally a character, and you know I love these quirky people and their stories.
Well, that makes two of us. All right, back to the investigation. In early November of 75, the Providence Journal reported that the Mafia knew that the heist was going to take place, that 20% of the safe deposit boxes held illicit gains, and that the Mafia had taken a cut of the proceeds from the theft.
But again, they were sure not to name Patriarca specifically. Now, supposedly, on November 2nd, a Providence newspaper ran a story that DuSalt was going to turn himself in for $100,000, and that was why Flynn and two other unnamed individuals were dispatched to kill DuSalt.
I could never find that article either, so I don't know. I can't say anything about that. But less than 2 weeks later, an attorney in Attleboro came forward stating that an intermediary of DuSalt's had approached him in September trying to negotiate a deal. There was an initial meeting with the intermediary and police at that time, but apparently the authorities weren't willing to give DuSalt what he wanted.
The attorney said that Doucette was looking for the same deal, to negotiate the same deal that Jack Kelly had gotten, immunity from prosecution and a new identity. Plus, he wanted $100,000, but at that point, law enforcement wasn't willing to cut a deal with him.
And I'm sorry, but Doucette was no Jack Kelly. The news reports about the Deuce wanting to pull a Jack Kelly allegedly led to a confrontation between Flynn and Doucette. And the Deuce wasn't just on the outs with Chucky. He was also abusing his girlfriend. She went to California to hide at her mom's home, but the Deuce went back to her Vegas apartment to track her down. The apartment complex manager reached out to her at her mother's to say that the Deuce had broken into the apartment and was living there. She told him to call the police.
And when the cops showed up, the Deuce not only had two different IDs, he also had a newspaper clipping of himself in his wallet, and that was the end of that.
Hey, listen, Dad carried his old Wanted posters around in his Prada bag, and when he'd be sitting sipping martinis with his waspy barfly friends, he'd pull those Wanted posters out to kind of, you know, get some thrill or some rise out of those people. But at least the statute of limitations had run out on his.
I mean, it
was kind of obscene, really, when you think about it.
Okay, let's get back to this obscenity. So the Deuce waived extradition and was quickly returned to Rhode Island, and it all went sideways for the crew. Nine suspects were arrested on the evening of January 5th. They included Flynn's common-law wife, who was charged with hiding him, and Cranston. Another couple, Charles and Carol Hopkins, were charged with harboring two fugitives in their Warwick home. The two fugitives being the Wimettes. Carol and Charles Hopkins were the sister and brother-in-law of John and Jerry Wimette.
Jack Tarzian was easy to find as he was back in the Worcester House of Correction on an earlier bank robbery charge that we mentioned in last week's episode. Denise was also picked up in Massachusetts.
And Tillinghast and Skippy were also arrested in Rhode Island. They were all sent to Cranston and held without bail. When Tillinghast complained about the conditions at the ACI, including the rats and cockroaches, the judge was unsympathetic and said that if people obeyed the law, there wouldn't be a need for prison. And what could Jerry do but agree?
It reminds me of one of my recent apartments.
And on that note, we're going to wrap it up today.
Agreed. Since we're almost at the trial, we will pick up next week right there. And thank you, guys, and looking forward to reading your comments, as usual. Bye.
Bye.